A psalm with a reason to give thanks for this Thanksgiving week.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Psalm 104, as I go through the Psalms, really struck me as an appropriate psalm for this Thanksgiving. I have been in it for a couple of weeks. I spoke the first time through it in a sermon a few weeks back, and really chose then to say, we need to share that during Thanksgiving week. It is a really, for me, it was a very powerful conviction, reminder of why giving thanks is so worthwhile no matter what's going on in life. And there are a lot of psalms that invite us to do that, but for reasons that strike me differently than this psalm did. And so I want to share this one with you. I think it comes in four parts. It's 35 verses long, a little long. And so I'm going to try as much as I can to give you the big pieces of why it goes the direction it does, and as much as possible, allow the verses to convey their own message, the meaning of the words to carry themselves. So the four sections that come out, verses 1 through 9, and then 10 through 18, and then 19 through 30, and then 31 through 35, I know that's just a bunch of numbers, but four pieces that are distinct enough that it doesn't take any complicated analysis to recognize where the changes are and what's being talked about. But in order to understand sort of where we're going with it, where I take it, where I understand it to go, I want to divide it into two pieces first and recognize the two big claims that I think are coming out of it. One, that time, the way time goes, demonstrates that God makes things right. And he uses that imagery in several different ways, but one of them just has to do with the fact that once God has begun to do something, he finishes it. And in finishing it, makes it right. So time demonstrates that God makes things right. And it does continuously demonstrate that, but really what I'm saying is it demonstrated that and therefore continues to show us that it's the case. So time is demonstrating that God makes things right. But then in the second half of the psalm, everything after verse 19, the attention goes away from time, the order of creation itself, and so on. This is a creation psalm, a lot to do with Genesis' account of creation, and maybe one other thing that I'll share with you in just a moment. But then the emphasis changes entirely to the content of that creation. It follows a lot the pattern of Genesis 1 that has to do with the world being without form and void, and I think the nature of Genesis 1 dividing the creation act itself into the first 3 days of giving it form, giving it some way of being, so separating light from darkness and the sky from the land and so on, giving it form, but then it's still being empty, it's still void, until he gives it content. It's teeming then with birds and fish, and the whole order of creation testifies to that, as we'll talk about as we go through the psalm itself. So by the time you get to the last half of this psalm, he's talking about all of those elements that occupy the creation, but they're not without order. They have a specific place and way of fitting together that gives testimony that God makes things right. Order, in this case, demonstrates that God makes things right. God fits things. So in the first half of the psalm, God finishes things, But in the last half of the psalm, it's the fact that God fits things. And so I'm not going to play off of that language through the whole thing, but I want to get that image into our minds, because the fact that God took the days of creation and led to the whole of creation being here, and then the fact that that whole creation all worked together in such a beautiful way, such a perfect way, that's the underpinning to this psalm, which just recapitulates the creation itself. It goes through all the elements of creation and uses them as a way of saying why we should continue to have faith in God and why we should be praising him, worshiping him, even thanking him for the things that are in the world, and maybe even the difficult things that are in the world. One other thing I'll clarify before I get further into it is this one exceptional oddity, two actually that show up, but they're the same oddity that show up twice in the psalm. There's one hint right at the beginning in verse 9. It's in the first section, at the very end of the first section, that hints that it's not about the original creation, or it's not only about the original creation, but also about the flood and the recreation that takes place during the time of Noah. And if you know the stories, you know that Noah's flood is a retelling of the creation of the world. Only this time, instead of Adam, it's Noah, and Noah goes on to sin again. But in recreating that world after the flood, you know, the land appears, and then the vegetation appears, and then the fowl is there bringing the plant. It's a recapitulation of the creation story itself. I'll read just a little of that to us to understand why it's there. But in verse 9, after all of this beautiful language that makes us think, really, at least as we're reading it, I don't know if original readers would have read it this way or not, but the way we're reading it and the way it fits all the language of Genesis 1, you know, it seems for all the world just to be about the creation. And then it says about the oceans, you set a boundary to God, it says, you set a boundary that they, the oceans, may not pass, so that they may not again cover the earth. Well, of course, they do cover the earth in the flood. If you're talking about the first creation, it wouldn't even be true. But if you're talking about the flood story now, I mean, it makes sense in light of the original creation, because God sets a boundary and there are seas. But they do cover the earth again. And then after the flood, the same promise is made. I'm not going to do this again. But in that promise, he never is going to let the waters come back. So something might be implied here about redemption. There's something where the collapse of things or the destruction of things has been brought up. And instead of just a creation story, we're having a redemption story. And then again, we have the last half of the psalm where everything is about everything being blessed and good and lights in the expanse of the heavens and, you know, all the contents. They all work together and fit together perfectly. And then this one anomalous statement at the end of the psalm in verse 35, the very last verse, let sinners, they weren't even present in the beginning, in any other verse in the psalm. And all of a sudden there are sinners in the last verse. Get those people out of here, right? So in verse 35, I know that's us too. Let sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. That's how he chooses to conclude a creation psalm. What on earth is going on with this? So that's what the fact that those two little, one so subtle, you might not even notice it if you're not really studying it. The other so obvious, you can't ignore it, that invites you to go back and read the rest of the psalm differently, that allows us, I think, to understand what the message of this psalm is actually about. Not just a sort of light, I want to use the word esoteric, sort of detached from everything in reality. Let's just get in a dark room and focus on how great creation is and sing that back to God. That would be worth doing, absolutely worth doing. But you understand what I mean by saying it's sort of an esoteric type of worship. It's out of the context of everything else. That's not how this psalm is given. I think in a very real world, meaning the world we exist in, I think we're supposed to read this psalm and understand something about why we worship God the way we do right now in the world this way. Why do you do that? So let's get to the psalm, starting in verse 1. About the creation or the recreation. Here are the words, bless the Lord. The first nine verses. I'm going to do this first section, which is about God using time to teach us that he finishes things, that he makes things right, okay? So we're going to do it in two sections, verses 1 through 9 and then 10 through 18. In verses 1 through 9, bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a tent. You can hear the creation account in this, right? Creating the firmament, stretching out the heavens like a tent. He lays the beams of his chambers on the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. He makes his messengers winds. By the way, if you think about how beautiful this language is, the idea of spirits, the angels being spirits and spirit, ruach, being wind and breath and spirit, and the angels being spirits and his messengers, so making the winds his messengers. It's really beautiful metaphorical language that you would grasp immediately in that way of seeing the world, and in ours might need a little more explanation. Maybe not as much as I gave it, but, you know, a little more explanation anyway. So he makes his messengers winds. He makes his servants, ministers, a flaming fire. He set the earth on its foundations, creation, so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. Here are the waters covering everything. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. Maybe all he means here, I'm reading it as a person going through the psalm. I'm not reading it and saying, well, maybe you're supposed to take it this way. Maybe you're supposed to take it that way. I mean, we're reading it right now and thinking, oh, maybe this is just a description of the creation. And he causes the waters to flee and he separates the land from the sea and then decides to create the landscape in it. So maybe the third day is going on, right? The waters stood above the mountains, but at your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank. It's just magnificent imagery of the creation. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them, and you set a boundary that those waters may not pass so that they might not again cover the earth. And in that moment, we realize, oh, wait a minute, I was thinking we're going through Genesis 1. Genesis 1, this part of the account, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. I'm reading from Genesis 1. And darkness was over the face of the deep. Here's God setting his chambers over the seas, over the deep. And the Spirit of God, he makes his ministers a spirit, right? A wind. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. That's where he puts his chambers. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there's evening and the morning the first day. And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. He stretches out the heavens like a tent, is how the psalm describes this moment or this comparable moment. Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters and let it separate the waters from the waters. Remember in the original creation, the waters are being separated and it creates the space of the heavens. And so he made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, second day. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place. So now the mountains are going to appear. The dry land is going to emerge. And the valleys are going to become their place. And so God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together, he called seas. And God saw that it was good. In this beautiful creation, God does all of those things that are described in Psalm 104, 1 through 9 as well. And the waters are now assuaging from the dry land so that there's dry land, as there's going to be after the flood as well. So the reality is we could just be describing the creation and God, you know, deciding the land is going to appear and it's not going to be covered anymore. And then as it describes it in Genesis 6, changing his mind, because that's how it describes it. I think it's an anthropomorphism for sure. But it is him saying, now I have to judge these people I wanted to bless. And so it uses that language about God deciding, regretting that he had made man or repenting that he had made man, whatever language you want to put on it, he's still thinking differently about man. And so in that moment, not because he didn't know, of course he knew, he's omniscient, he's omnipotent, all of those things are unquestioned in my mind. But because of that, he does flood the earth, and maybe it's just a changing of the mind. But I think that as we're reading these first nine verses, of Psalm 104, we're supposed to hear the creation, think about this poetic. I know Genesis 1 is poetic language, but this is a poetic description, a metaphorical description. So we get all of these beautifications in our mind of what's going on in those moments of creation. We read all of this thinking of the creation, and then I think we're supposed to read in verse 9, you set a boundary that they may not pass. Ooh, yeah, God created the dry land so that they might not again cover the earth, and think to ourselves, oh, wait, I thought this was the creation, but this was the recreation. This was how beautifully God created the world in Noah's day after he had destroyed the world. And then I think we're supposed to look at verses 10 through 18, which are still about this part of creation, how magnificently he brings all these things together to understand what he's accomplished. So in Genesis 1, the part of the creation that's described here is starting in verse 11. God said, this is Genesis 1, the part I think that's going to follow now in Psalm 104, 10 through 18, what I'm about to read to you. In Genesis 1, it's this, and God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. You hear the abundance that's being described just in the creation account of Genesis 1. I'll put it in the context of that destruction I was talking about a moment ago in just a second. But the psalm itself, Psalm 104, describes all of that, I think, this way in verse 10. You make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, bread to strengthen man's heart. The trees of the Lord are watered abundantly. The cedars, this is an emphatic statement, the best trees, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. In them the birds build their nests. The stork has her home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The rocks are a refuge for the rock badgers. The abundance, of course, makes perfect sense in light of the original creation as well. But because of the words that he's caused the waters to have a line, a boundary, so that they can never again cover the earth, then you hear Noah being able to release the animals into these places where God has created a new Eden. I mean, he's created a place with mountains and valleys, but where God himself is still watering the mountains and the springs are gushing forth and the grass is growing abundantly and the trees are putting out their fruit and all the animals are finding their home in it. there was a time of destruction. There was a time, even in the original creation story, a time of chaos or without, you know, that these things didn't exist and weren't there. But now there is abundance. But if you put it in the context of the flood story, especially, then you say there was a time of destruction. There was. But now there is abundance. And if you hear it in the flood story itself, it comes in Genesis 8, where it says, "But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark." So here are all those beasts that come in at the end of the passage we just read in Psalm 104. "And God made a wind blow over the earth." That account fits so well the first part of Psalm 104 we were reading. "God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed. The rain from the heavens was restrained, and the waters receded from the earth continually." Those statements fit this part of the psalm so well. I just can't imagine that the people who knew this book like the back of their hand didn't recognize that this was an appeal, or didn't determine that this was an appeal to, not only to the original creation, which I think is there. I think that appeal is there. But then to remind them that God did this in a way that said that flood would never come again. That the destruction was there. God had created a perfect world, and we filled it with so much evil that he brought judgment on it. But from that judgment resurrected the beauty of this land that is well-watered and in pastures and meadows that are abundant and streams flowing in the valleys and everything perfectly provided for, so that in reading that flood story, and this fits 2 Peter 3 so perfectly, we already have the story of God redeeming the world from its sin through this traumatic event of the flood that happened. Why wouldn't we believe he's going to do it again? That would be the point. If the psalm had ended at verse 18, we would simply be saying, look, in the past, time has given testimony to the fact that God is going to make things right in the world. He made them right to begin with, and then he restored that when he flooded the world and then recreated it with Noah and all the animals in the ark, and then gave them this abundance again. You and I both know that didn't result in the redemption of the world permanently. Noah becomes Adam immediately. I'm going to take the fruit too. He just took a different kind of fruit, right? I don't know. Maybe it's the same kind. We don't know for sure what kind it was. Whatever the point is, Noah fails. Yeah, but God didn't fail to make the world new. He made it new. So time has given testimony that God makes things right. God fixes things. God comes and repairs things that were wrong. And we have the testimony of that in history. That's not the end of the psalm, though. The psalm goes on now not to be about day after day of creation or God having a redemptive moment after all of our destruction, but to put all the elements that are in that creation into their complementarity, into their way of fitting together, their dependency on each other, their interdependency. And to use that as a way of saying, can you not look at how beautifully, how in such complexity this world fits together and works in the way that it does, and see that God makes things right? Doesn't the order of the creation itself testify that God makes things right? I know, and you know, there are things that are out of order. I know, and you know, there are earthquakes and tornadoes and all kinds of things that happen, so that people who have no blame in the moment are suffering because of what's going on in the world. I know, and you know that, and we're going to have to figure that out. Hence verse 35, by the way, if you want a preview of where we're going, of course. But the point in the psalm is to say, we recognize, and think about this for a second, we recognize that those things are wrong because so many things are right. We expect the world to function the way we know it ought to because of the testimony of how often it functions exactly that way, in the right way, things work. And so the description of that comes starting in verse 19 in Psalm 104. But let me read it to you in the, you know, in the filling the earth, in the giving it content part, where it was void, but now it's going to have content. So the fourth, fifth, and sixth days, what this is about. Genesis 1 puts it this way in verse 14. God said, let there be lights, not light, but lights in the heavens, in the expanse of the heavens, to separate the day from the night. So in this creating content, there is inherently built into it a creation of order, the way things are going to work. Here are the lights that are going to cover the day. Here are the lights that are going to cover the night. So there's a way of things fitting together. So separates the day from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. They have a purpose. It's not just time now, but we're going to create an order that's going to work together like a clock, you know, clockwork creation here. Verse 15, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. This is in Genesis 1 I'm reading. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. It's so hard for me not now to pause and give a brief lecture on astronomy. But anyway, in verse 18, to rule over the day and over the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures. I love this description because it's like God creates the ocean and then he says, we're going to need to fill that up. So let's just do it now. And in the ocean, it's just all of a sudden teeming with sea life, with all of the fish. It's the language God uses to describe what happens to Israel in Egypt. In the time from Joseph and then going to Exodus 1, it says Israel was teeming in the land. It's this same word. That's how God blesses them to multiply. That's how he's using this word. Look at how God is abundantly blessing the world in its order by providing, just like he provided grass and the trees with their abundant fruit, now the oceans have this abundance of living creatures in them. The birds are teeming in the expanse of the heavens, and so let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. And so God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas and let the birds multiply on the earth. So in verse 19 of Psalm 104, it picks up this way. He made the moon to mark the seasons. So now everything is setting lines for how and where and when things are supposed to happen. And they're going to happen in their proper order. He made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. You make darkness and it's night. When all the beasts, here's part of the order, when all the beasts of the forest creep about, as I'm reading this, hear him saying, here's, you know, we go to bed at night and all the animals come out and they go do their thing. They go do their job. I got to go eat that. I got to go over here. And then they go back home. And then we come out in the daytime and we occupy the same place they were, but we're there at a different time. And then we go back to bed and they come back out. It's just this amazing clockwork. I know how simplistic that is. I realize how silly it sounds, but it's also really beautiful. And when you think about even your home where you are, all the things that are going on while we're not paying attention to it. This is the point. This is what makes it beautiful. It's not a coincidence that the animals come out when we're not there. I know that. That's not the point. The point is you're sleeping at night while God is still causing the world to do all of the things it does. And while the animals are sleeping, they're not thinking, boy, I hope those people are doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're not thinking anything about you. They're just going to sleep. But God's thinking about you. That's the thing. You're not thinking about all the other things that are happening in the world that God is thinking about when you're not. That order is what I'm talking about here. Okay, back to the verses. So the young lions, they roar for their prey. They've come out, you know, at night. All the beasts of the forest, they creep about. The young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. When the sun rises, they steal away and they lie down in their dens. Man goes out to his work and to his labor until the evening. O Lord, How manifold are your works? In wisdom, you've made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Here is the sea. And this is this section is what forces us to say what the point here is in this section of the psalm, which is not just, oh, it's cool that you put things out there at night while I'm asleep during the day, but to say God is doing things in the invisible part of the world to us. God is active in parts of the world we don't even think about existing. We barely see past the end of our nose, and God is at work on the other side of the world. He's at work at the bottom of the ocean when all we care about is the ship that's slipping across the top of it. So here's how that goes in verse 25. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable. Think about their way of seeing the world. The sea is the chaotic place where God's barely even in charge. Maybe Baal's in charge there. But on that sea, it's God who is at work. So here's how he says it again. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable, living things, both small and great. So there go the ships and Leviathan, which you have formed to play in it. The point here is that God, nothing exists. None of those elements exist unless God is giving them their provision. None exists apart from God's constant provision. This, and the emphasis on that comes in the next four or five verses. These all look to you, starting in verse 27. These all, like Leviathan, the thing we don't even see in the bottom of the ocean down there, these all look to you to give them their food in due season. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they're filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to the dust. When you send forth your spirit, they're created. Here's another little nod toward the recreation instead of just creation. When you send forth your spirit, he says in verse 30, they are created and you renew the face of the ground. But in this case, he had gone back and described how intimately God has created the world so that all the elements fit together and rely on each other, depend on each other, work within their seasons with each other to give a demonstration that in the order of creation, God sets things right. He makes them right. Nothing is happening that isn't a part of that creation. The Lord does good things that we don't see and we don't understand. It's like there's our world that we're living in, and then there's another world that God is also ordering that supports this world. It's like that. He doesn't use that language, but it's like that. We would have no idea what all's involved in it. And the more we've done with astronomy to look out into the heavens, or with microscopy to look down at the little tiny beings or particles of beings that form our entire world, the more we realize how much more complex the interdependencies and complementarities are that make the world work the way it does. I mean, who knew we had a biome living inside of our stomachs that makes it possible for us to exist in a healthy state? And yet here we are, depending on billions of little creatures living inside of us to make things work for us. God is the one who put all that order together, and it's what helps us to be able to see. Well, that's what the very end of the psalm talks about, so that's what we go to now. The last five verses, starting in verse 31, and this is a reason to praise him, even when the earth does tremble. And this is the point, that God set the earth on its foundation so that it would never be moved. That's how the psalm opened up. And now we're going to be describing it in a way that makes the mountains shake. The earth trembles whenever God just looks at it. That's all he has to do. So it's not contradictory. It's the same psalm. You know, it's a beautiful language to say, we know you have made the earth what it is. And now we recognize that even when Leviathan is there, even when that dangerous serpent from the sea is there, no matter what it is, whatever Leviathan is, that thing that seems so threatening and so dangerous, we realize that it couldn't even exist if God hadn't given it life. Not only that, it couldn't exist for another moment if God didn't give it its breath. And so in all of those things, we respond by saying, then I have a reason to praise God even when the earth is trembling, even when evil is still present. And I know we can make this part. We can make this claim. I'm going to make it now. We can make this claim from probably 30 of the Psalms that we've covered so far, maybe more, maybe 102 of the 103 that we've already covered. Not necessarily all in episodes, but I've covered 103 of them to this point. Even if we can make this claim, there is another claim to be made. This claim that I'm saying is, when we look at the fact that God is in charge of this creation, then we can trust that what he's going to do is going to make things right. This is the time part of the argument. In the creation, God made things so beautiful, we recognized how wonderful it was, and then we blew it, and all this evil showed up in the world, and oh no, what's going to happen? He's going to make it again. He's going to flood the earth, and he's going to start again, and Noah's going to see that God is still in charge because, oh my soul, look at how magnificent the world is again. The mountains are emerging. The valleys are filled with streams. The hills are covered with the grass for the animals that are coming off my ark. And wow, God, this is beautiful. So time gives us this testimony that says, no matter how bad things seem now, hang in there because he's going to make it right in the end. That is an important part of redemption's story. That is an important part of our prayer. How long, O Lord, until you make these things right? This psalm, though, does one thing beyond that. In verses 31 through 5, it says it this way. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works, who looks on the earth and it trembles. This is not for a different day. This is for now. God looks on the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. Now, again, this is all poetic, metaphorical language, but I mean, we see the mountains smoke. Just drive through Tennessee and you see the mountains, you know, the Smoky Mountains. That's what they're called. We see that. We're supposed to see that and say, oh, yeah, God's not absent from the world. The way the creation is ordered, the beauty, we see it. We see the order of creation. The things that disturb us about the creation, the things that make us say, well, if there is a God, why would he have made it that way? Those things only disturb us because we can see all those testimonies in all of the rest of creation that make us say, man, that is magnificent. Look at the power of this, the expanse of this, the majesty of this, the complexity of this. There's so many different ways to see it and say it that we all do experience. So he says, but the Lord looks on the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. These are things that happen in our world. There's an earthquake, there's a shake. And we're able to say, oh, yeah, this is a reminder. There's not just this surface level where I'm on a ship on the surface of the ocean. There's also the Leviathan below that gets his breath from God as well. Therefore, I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. May my meditation be pleasing to him, because I rejoice in Yahweh. This, after all of that description of the beauty, order, perfection that's in the world, all the completeness, all the things we don't see that we know God is giving attention to, in all of that, may my meditation be pleasing to him, because I'm going to rejoice in Yahweh. And then these words, let sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. The final words of the psalm he follows with are where he began. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Hallelujah. We translate it, praise the Lord. That's how it's put into our English Bibles normally. But it's the word hallelujah. That's how he concludes the psalm. Here's my praise for God, where I'm acknowledging again, yeah, there is evil in the world. And we can try to soften it and avoid it. Well, you know, it's just for those few, we're literally wicked people. No, I mean, sin in the world means evil in the world. It means suffering in the world, sinners in the world. means the confrontation with all of those evils that have come into our life. They come into our lives mostly through human interaction. That's where we experience it. And we all know we have brought that misery to others. And when we brought that misery to others, we're the ones they're praying about. Oh, Lord, how long until you make things right and eliminate the world of that evil Barry Creamer? You know, that's the prayer of others. Daisy's nodding in acquiescence as I pray the prayer. The point is that, you know, we're all the sinners. I know we're all the sinners. We all recognize this is not just picking out people we don't like. This is all of us. This is all the evil in the world that we're talking about. Let them be consumed from the earth. Let the wicked be no more, meaning this time, make the earth right. Why can we have confidence that would be? The thing he adds to the idea that in the past, we've seen God make wrongs right. We saw him flood the earth and create a new world with Noah. We've seen God make things right with the judgment of the wicked in the past. Time has taught us that if we wait long enough, God will make things right again. That's true. But what he adds to that here is that the order of creation that we experience every day, every time we take a breath and are again satisfied with the next moment of our being. Every time we eat a bite of food, we should be thinking to ourselves, God, thank you for this abundance. We're way too unappreciative of how much God does to provide for us. I have a friend who always gives thanks to God for making the world in color instead of black and white because we get to see color. Do you realize how magnificent the colors are you see every moment of every day? If you're colorblind, I apologize for this portion of the discussion. But you know what I mean. It's beautiful. It is beautiful that we get to see things in color, that we get to hear sounds that are dynamic, that we get to smell things that are floral or rancid, and that we get to experience the contrast to that. You know, our experience in this life is a testimony to the well-ordered nature of creation. And again, those moments that cause us to detest what's happening in the world right now only cause us to detest it because we've experienced so much time and so much of the normality that knows that God has created an orderly and beautiful world. In that testimony, the order of things, we have this evidence of a reason, not just to praise God in the future when he makes things right, but to praise a God who exists now and will make things right in the future. He's giving things their breath. This does not, I find it to be an error to say to ourselves, oh, well, God is giving breath to sinners, so the sin must be okay. That is to me exactly the same as saying, why not sin the more that grace may abound? That's not the point. The point isn't God needed sinners in order to make his act of redemption apparent to everyone. I don't understand that to be the point. As I'm reading it, I understand him to be saying, you can still thank me for this world because not one part of it could continue to exist if I weren't giving it breath. And because of that, you can count on me making it right. Not you can count on it being made right and hold out for that day, but you can count on the me who is with you right this moment. You can count on me to make it right. You may have a hard time giving thanks for an event. That's fine. I understand that. Yeah, in everything give thanks to God. In everything recognize that God is still keeping us in this beautiful, ordered world where the testimony is that he's going to make everything right. So when he says that second time, bless the Lord, O my soul, praise the Lord, even the most difficult things in this world are still in his world. So we can worship him because we know he is greater than they are. Not because they're good, because they're in his world, but because we know he is greater than they are, because it is still his world. And we know that God will fit things together. He'll do it someday, but because we see what he's done in the past, And because we see the order he has put in creation, we know it today. So we give him thanks today.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.